This week's show with Karen Teresi is sponsored by the Embroiderers Guild of America at egausa.org. One thing to note here coming up is the end of early registration for the national seminar, which will be in New York City next year. Broadway Bound is the name of the seminar, and early registration ends October 5. Also, when you visit the EGA website, you want to go to the events section, because we focus a lot on the national seminar, but the various regions also have their own events, and those are all listed on the in the events section. And for many people, those might be more approachable in terms of travel. For instance, the 2021 Pacific Southwestern Region Annual Seminar is October 27 to 31 in Las Vegas. And it looks like you can still register for that and participate, have a really nice lineup of instructors and classes. So check that out. And you want to stay on top of that events page because there's always something going on. Now, November 7 to 12 in Williamsburg, Virginia, there will be a presentation, Contemporary Geometric Beadwork Demythicized, by Sam Norgaard. And then coming up December 1 to 5, also in Williamsburg, is Christmas at Williamsburg 2021. So some excellent events coming up here before the end of the year. So keep tabs on that events section. You'll probably find something you like and something that's an easy travel distance for you. Also, for non-members, and you should become a member, just join either through the a local chapter, or you can be a member at large. That's what I am, as a member at large, and it works very well for me. But whether you're a member or not, they always have free projects, and there are some really wonderful projects that are available on the free project page. Two of them, the theme of the month, Halloween and fall. There's a pumpkin embroidery project from Stitch Floral, and then there's a Halloween blackwork biscornu by Kim Beamish. And when I saw that one, I thought, that's a nice little design, and it's also the kind of design that you can just simply change colors on and stitch yourself and make a biscornu for different holidays and different seasons. So that's a good one just to download and have throughout the year. And then if you want a nice little challenge, Judy Giroy has offering a free stumpwork butterfly project. So those are all free. They're free to members or non-members in the free project section on the EGA website. So check all those out. Consider being a member, and be sure and check out the Broadway Bound National Seminar classes. And if you haven't registered already, get registered by October 5. And then I believe after that, registration just opens up to the world. So act quickly if you want to be sure and get in. Things fill up quickly, but a tremendous lineup of classes for next year in New York City. And with that, on to our conversation this week with Karen Teresi. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, Karen Teresi. Karen, welcome.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Doing okay. Our topic today is beading, but tambour beading. And what a fascinating world you guys live in. Boy, nothing but glitter and sparkle and reflection. It's a fun world.
Yes, it's a very sparkly world indeed.
Yeah, that's the thing with tambour beading, tambour embroidery beading, whatever. When an untrained eye, which I have, looks at it, it all is just, it literally is that, just sparkle and glimmer and shine. And to me, it all looks the same, but I'm sure there's a difference. Do you guys have different styles and different approaches that distinguish each of you? How does that evolve over time?
Okay, well, technically tambour is a technique that is supposed to be quite uniform. So it
Oh,
doesn't
okay.
surprise me that, it doesn't surprise me that you look at it and it looks all the same. Because fundamentally, the stitches and the basis for all the stitches, you follow some pretty strict guidelines and some pretty strict traditional rules in order to make those happen. How you develop, I guess, a style is more through your design and the materials that you choose, and also too that the colors that you work with and how much of, I guess, thread work you use in with or separate to the different types of beads and whether you use them together or whether you use more of one or of another. And also too, your style tends to be embedded a lot in the designs that you choose. And that shines through a lot more, say, than the actual stitch itself. Tambour was originally kind of, I guess, brought about and came into the sphere of fashion because it was a faster way to apply lots and lots of smaller beads onto really, really delicate fabrics. And as you can imagine, in like the 1920s and the 30s, you know, those beautiful flapper dresses during that period, what was really, I guess, important was to have a unique style or line drawing of beading. But then tambour beading made it possible to for you know beading to almost become production, I suppose. So it could go like the work itself could go out to more than one beader, and you could get a same result, I suppose, because the tambour stitch itself is very uniform. So yeah, so it's kind of it is a bit regimented and does look a bit samey, but in the right hands with the right experience, you can actually bring it to life and bring parts of the stitching and the design itself to have a unique style.
So then, if I understand that correctly, then there's really a melding of manufacturing, high speed production and art to make this all work.
Definitely. Absolutely. And how tambour works itself, in essence, because it's a very specialized skill, when you first learn it, it's unlike any other needlework that you'll learn and that you'll try. So, learning it, even if you've got no embroidery experience or lots of embroidery experience, everybody starts from the same level. And then what happens is the more years of experience you've got, the more you can bring to the work. So, you bring speed to the work, you bring technical difficulty and manipulation of materials to the work. So you tend to find with tambour that the longer you do it, the more creative you can be with the actual design and the materials and the stitches themselves. So it works quite well once you've had some experience. It's not easy when you first learn it, but it's oh gosh, and it's a tricky one to teach too, because I think everybody sees those wonderful videos now on YouTube and it looks so fast.
Oh, you guys literally fly through that stuff. It's just amazing to me.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that's because 9 times out of 10, you're watching someone who's experienced with a hook in their hand. And when you are experienced, yes, you do fly along. That's the benefit of the stitch, definitely. But when you're first starting, it requires a lot of patience and a lot of dedication to actually kind of get past the awkward stage into the stage where you feel comfortable with the stitch. Yeah, I
The
know. It's a
awkward
bit of a
stage,
dedicated
yeah.
one. Yeah, I know. Not as easy as picking up a needle, but I tell you what, if you give it love, my gosh, it gives you amazing stuff back. So it's a
Yeah.
pretty wonderful thing to do.
So then one of the advantages is, if I understand correctly, then on a movie set or in preparation for a theater performance, then more than one person can work on a garment and get it done and not have it look all wonky.
Exactly. And I guess that's where a lot of skill comes into the design part, which sometimes that's left in the embroiderer's hands. Sometimes it's actually designed by a designer themselves or an embroidery designer. And so what then happens is, yes, you can have two or three people working on the one piece with instruction and obviously a really good bead key so that they know what beads to put where, because that has to be as involved sometimes as the line drawing, just that map. But they do the same for haute couture as well. So, you know, these days, and I think, you know, for as long as I've been working, definitely, you know, deadlines are always very tight. And when a deadline's tight, the more people you've got and the more hands you've got, the better it is. So, yeah, and it's much easier to work with a whole group of people, and for you to all be to working together to one brief is really a great thing to do. Right.
Yeah. I never appreciated how much of tambour beading is done. And I've talked to two or three of you artists, and it's like when you buy a car model, then you see that car everywhere. Same kind of thing. I never realized how much tambour beading is done. It's just, I mean, it's everywhere if you know where to look.
Exactly. And tambour beading exists really in two forms. It exists in the French way, which the chain stitch is always on the back of the fabric. And it also exists in India as ari work. And the chain stitch actually runs through the beads. So tambour in one form or another has been around for a really, really long time, and it's in probably more manufacturing than, like you said, than you imagine. The minute you start to look for it, it starts to pop up and you think, wow. And even sometimes with the different embroideries as well, it might have two or three different types of embroideries involved in it. So maybe the base will be worked by tambour, and then maybe three-dimensional elements will be added on afterwards or things like that. So it's, you know, a technique that you can use in conjunction with other embroideries too.
Yeah. Let's go back and talk about, how did you get to this point? Did you do needlework when you were young? Were you an artist? How do you get to this point?
Okay. When I was growing up, I have a Norwegian mother and an Italian father. So
now there's
my
a combination.
Grandparents, yeah, exactly. And when you're from Australia, it's very common to have mixed relationship, like mixed ethnicities in you know, your parents. So they tend to be from everywhere, which is so great. And I'm sure America's the same in one form or another. And so, as you can imagine, there's a rich history from both of those cultures with textile, stitching, knitting, weaving. So it was always present in my sphere. My grandfather was a wood carver, so he did really intricate detailed inlay work and things like that. So I always had creativity in and around in my family. So it was always in my view, if you like.
What a fun way to grow up.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I've got some fabulous memories when I was a child of sitting on the bench in my grandfather's workshop and playing with wood curls that he'd shaved and planed off furniture. Yeah. And the smell of wood to this day fills me with such a wonderful, warm, nostalgic feeling. So, so it's always been in my sphere. And my mum was sewing at one point. So she started making clothes for herself and for us. And like every young person does in Australia, if you go to high school, sometimes, you know, as a girl, you do like a textile course, and you do 2 years at school where they teach you how to do hand sewing and knitting and just the basics. And while I was there, I was kind of got interested in fashion. It sort of kind of took my fancy because it was very glamorous. And the fashion at that time was the 80s, you know, so it was very, very like dramatic. You know, you had all those big designers on the French catwalks and, you know, the clips we got on the news and everything like that were just so exciting to me. I thought, wow. And then between those costumes and then costumes for music video clips and theatrical performing clips, I was just like, wow, you know, I was blown away. So that was definitely in my view as a teenager. So towards the end of my schooling, I kind of made a decision really that I wanted to go into making clothes in some way. And the most obvious direction, I suppose, was to go towards fashion, because it was a course that I could enroll in. It was close to where I was living with my parents at the time. And it was during that course that I really got a taste for embroidery. And I learned how to do all the fashion-y stuff, like making patterns and also to, you know, designing and doing different things. But it was the handwork that I got so addicted to. I was like, oh, wow, any hand sewing, put my hand up, I'll do it, I'll do it. You know, so it was kind of coming out slowly, slowly. And then the longer I was there and the more we're exposed to, you know, French fashion and theatre and costume, I was just, it was like a wonderland for me. It was like, wow, like I want to learn how to do that, you know. And in Australia at the time, it was a little bit limited as to where I could learn those skills, especially something that specialised.
Yeah.
So, so I finished my fashion degree, which was fantastic, and I went and worked in the industry as an assistant designer and an assistant pattern maker at one point. I tried a few different things.
Okay, let's back up a little bit here. The fashion degree, what does that get you? Does that get you enough knowledge to design and build clothing?
Yes, exactly.
So that's
right.
All the basics. That's pattern making, cutting, of that. Okay.
Exactly. So if I was to go and get a job for a label, say, for example, in, you know, that did women's wear, ready to wear clothing, you know, somewhere that would sell in Berghoff and Goodman or, you know, even anything from a high street store to fast fashion. So it was, we could basically start with a blank piece of paper and a drawing, and we could create patterns, cut the fabric, stitch that piece, and then market it as well. So that was pretty much it. So that
gave you the fundamentals, but
yes,
your interest then was, I want the handwork, I want the shiny sparkly stuff.
Yes, because we did electives in our final year. And in our final year, that was where the embroidery came in and the beading came in. And oh my God, it just that was it. It stole my heart. I was like, oh, I can't do anything else. This is what I have to do forever. So it was really, really inspiring. And I think, you know, also for me is like, I was so enthusiastic about it. I just wanted to learn as much as I could, as quickly as I could. You know, we all want to run, you know, we want to take off. So, but yes, so that was really fun.
So then you get out into the work world and then I have to start at the bottom, I assume. And so are you doing basically grunt work while in the back of your head is, I want to do this embroidery, this tambour embroidery?
Absolutely. Definitely, definitely. Yeah. You know, you go in on the ground level, one up from making coffee, you know, it's always the same story. Everyone can make good coffee by the time they've gone through the beginning of fashion. But no, what was fabulous was that I think coming in at the ground level is really good because you do see and fix and get involved with a lot of stuff that, and when I say stuff, you know, processes within the business that you can see where you might want to be long term. So which area, whether you want to be in design or whether you want to be in the making part of things, because they're two very separate areas. In fashion particularly. And I think even into today's day, it's very, very different. Design and production are very separate entities.
Yeah, that was something I learned. I forget who it was I talked to that does tambour before. Is I did not appreciate the distinction between design and production. That's, it's like completely different operations.
Absolutely. And it's really, really different skills for the people who work in those areas. So, you know, the business end as well. So marketing and social media, you know, that's a whole nother part of the business as well. And the production part of things is very much the making of. So it's actually bringing a beautiful picture or a beautiful image to life. And for me, I think I knew the part that I wanted to be involved in. Yeah. I love the design part. I almost see that as a bit indulgent for myself, the design part. You know what I mean? I love the make so much. The design part is the indulgent part, you know. Whereas some people choose careers where, you know, it's all design and that's all they want to do. They don't want to make. And that's fine. Both require different skills. So
But then your education, because different skills and different worlds, But you still have to understand each other. Like, you can't do a design that somebody can't actually make. There has to be that understanding, right?
Yes, absolutely. And to be honest, the more knowledge a designer has of the different processes, and especially with embroidery process or pleating or fabric manipulation, things like that, the more processes they understand, the better designer they become, because they can offer more. Mm-hmm. If you know what I mean. You know, they can actually, you know, they take an inspiration from one thing and mix it with something else. And if they know that those two processes can work together, it makes them a much more powerful designer. So, so I guess, you know, but like most things, you then kind of almost become a jack of all trade, master of none. So a good designer will be really aware of the different processes, but might not necessarily be absolutely perfect at doing it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? They'll always have someone on hand who will produce samples that realize what they're talking about. Does that make sense? Because it requires a different skill set in order to do that.
Right. But the comprehension is really critical.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Definitely. Definitely. Yeah.
So for you, it's making, and then how is it's making, but then how do you find your way into being able to do the beading part?
Yes. Okay. So because I love beading so much, and because I thought, wow, you know, this is pretty amazing to learn. Looking overseas, I could tell that the embroidery was a separate job. Over in France, especially France. And I kind of took a lot of my cue from haute couture fashion in the way that I looked at how that was working, because it was the most visible, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And just noticing that there were embroiderers, that's all they did for their job. And I thought to myself, do you know, if I can just be an embroiderer, I would prefer to do that. I'll do whatever it takes, one, to learn how to be that, two, get as many skills as I possibly can to be able to do that, and then three, absolutely try to get nerves of steel to say no to any other work that isn't embroidery, because that's the hard part.
Right.
And with what we do, especially with embroidery and freelance embroidery particularly, is that if you start to do other things, sometimes what you get known for doing is what you stay doing, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you really want to be an embroiderer, it's actually your own worst enemy is to try and actually do other things, because then you might end up not doing any embroidery at all. So for me, it was like, okay, be brave. Say no to all the pattern making work. Say no to the dressmaking. Just say yes to the embroidery.
Okay, what's the mental aspect of that that says to you, I want to commit everything to beading? What is it about the design and the art that hooks you in?
I love that it's meditative.
Okay.
I love that I have to calm my mind in order to do it. I love that I place each and every stitch in the way, like, I'm responsible for that. Does that make sense? Like, that every point of my needle, that every stitch I make has come and, like, it's basically come from my knowledge, my personality, my vision, my passion, and that I can actually take a plain piece of fabric, and by applying things to that fabric, I give it a different identity. And I find that is really exciting for me. And really putting in all the passion that I have, because I find placing stitches, you know, one at a time for me is really, it's powerful.
Yeah.
I know for a lot of people, they say to me, oh my gosh, you've got patience. How do you do that every day? You know, one little stitch at a time. And it's like, yeah, but once there's something meditative about it that it, I don't know, it just takes me to a place that I really like to be. You know, psychologically, emotionally, everything. Yeah.
Yeah. See, and I could feel that in your voice when you started to talk about it. I could feel like your mind immediately went to that little world. That's fun.
Yeah, exactly right. And I know that a lot of people in life, you know, they take themselves to different dream worlds, I guess. You know, whether it be one that they narrate or one that they write about or something like that. But I know for me, mine is definitely in my stitching. It just takes me to another place, and it's really nice. It's a beautiful place.
So in the work world, so you make that conscious decision. This is what I'm going to do. I'm blocking everything out, and you just fight your way through to. But there had to have been tons of hours of learning to get very skilled and proficient at tambour beating.
Yes, absolutely. I did the first part of my education was a private tuition for the good part of a year, one-on-one, with an amazing woman in Australia called Maisie Jarrett. She authored some books, and one on hand beating and a few on tambour. And she did an apprenticeship in Sydney at the age of 13 with a dressmaker there who was French, who taught her tambour. And so she'd been tambour beating her whole life. And my mum found her just through the book, and we called her up and I said, look, you know, I really want to learn how to do this. And she said, great, you know, come on up and come and do regular lessons. So that was a start of some really powerful learning for me, because it was important to me that I learnt things properly. I didn't, you know, there's only so much self-guided, I guess, teaching you can do that. If you actually learn from someone who's a professional at something or someone who's done it all their life, they give you little tips and tricks that books and, you know, bits and pieces or self-teaching, you can sometimes miss those things. Mm-hmm. So I found that was really, really powerful. And then I started working with those skills, and it took me the good part of 6 months to a year to get my speed up. And, then in 1999, I went and did courses at Lesage in Paris. So I did 4 months full-time there, and I did the complete haute couture level, which was 7 levels at the time. And, lots and lots and lots of work, but it was invaluable. It was so wonderful. The experience of living it that long in Paris just blew my mind. I was poor as anything. I had no money, but, oh, my gosh, it was just so, you know, all you have to do is walk the streets of Paris, right? They're so beautiful. And coming from Australia, like, it's completely, completely different world. It's just, oh, it's where dreams are made for me, really. They're beautiful, beautiful, beautiful places. And, so I went there and I studied for 4 months and made some great friends and, you know, got through all my levels, finished all my samples. And at that stage, I'd had an atelier in Sydney. So I had some, you know, obviously I'd built work up to a point where I had other people who I'd trained and they were helping me. And, yeah, so that then just took my business to the next level, and it was so exciting. Oh, it was
okay, so
amazing.
I did not realize that. So you, atelier. Say it again for me.
Yeah, atelier.
Atelier.
Yeah. So it's
so
like
you already had that going in Australia. You had a business going in Australia.
Yes. And the business kind of grew organically. When I learnt my skills from Maisie, I started working in bridal because it was the most obvious place at the time where people were doing made to measure and putting beads on gowns and garments in Australia. So it made sense to me, okay, I'll start working in bridal and let's see how it goes. And I noticed at the time that in one particular business, or any businesses, I suppose, that I worked with at that time, there wasn't enough work to work there full time, but there was enough work to take maybe one gown away every couple of weeks. And providing that the designers were happy with me to take them away and do them, it meant that I could freelance. And so what I did was is I got my own studio at that point, and I thought, well, look, you know, it's better for the designers. It's more cost effective for the designers for me to just moonlight when they need me, you know, to be able to work when they need me. And so I did that for a while, and then just, you know, as time passed and the more designers I met and the more designers I showed my work, the more work I got. And then before I knew it, I had too much just for me. And so I was like, oh, God, what do I do now? And I had a really, really great close friend of mine who she came and worked with me, and you know, Peas in a Pod, who's wonderful, and she's talented, talented beater. And her name's Deborah Horn. And and so she worked with me for many, many years, and the business just slowly grew. Like, before we knew it, we had more and a bit more and a bit more, and another designer would come on board, and then, you know, we'd get recommended to someone else. And so before I knew it, I had 10 full-time staff.
Oh, my.
And
oh, you really?
I know.
Oh, my.
That was, yeah. And that was definitely not the plan, you know. Like, you know.
I just wanted to bead.
Exactly. And to be absolutely fair, like, if I had if there was a beading atelier that already existed in Sydney, I would have just gone and worked for them. Mm-hmm. But that didn't exist there. It existed in Europe, existed in England, but it didn't exist in Sydney. So, yeah, you know, they kind of, I sort of had just, you know, made it up as we went along. But, you know, obviously then getting some more training in a business and marketing sense helped me along.
Yeah.
And then getting the training in Paris helped along as well. And yeah, so it was interesting journey, that one.
Yeah. So after your training in Paris, did you come back to Australia and continue, or did you stay in Europe?
No, I came back to Australia mainly because of the business. Yeah. And I felt that when I came back, I was a bit in two minds, if you like. Part of me wanted to come back because I do love being in Australia, and I was working on some fantastic things.
Yeah.
But also too, part of me wanted to stay in Europe and try and actually work for some of the houses.
Right.
But unfortunately at the end of my courses there, it wasn't as easy to get work as a foreigner in the Parisian embroidery houses. These days it's a little bit different, but back then it was very, very difficult. Yeah. Mm. They preferred it if you were French, and that's okay. That's fine. You know, language barriers and skill sets and things like that. So no, I very much understand that. So back to Australia I went, and I still did some fabulous work. You know, I can't fault it. It's just been a different journey, I suppose, like a long one.
Right.
To get to haute couture. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that the starting point? Is wedding dresses, is that where, is that kind of like the learning ground, where you develop your skills and your talents and then move on? Is that fairly typical, or is it just another option?
Okay. I think to be, it depends, I think, solely on your city, where you grow up, where you live, and what's available in and around where you live. Every city around the world seems to have different industries and different opportunities. And I think it's really important to respond to that, you know, as an embroiderer, as a person. Yeah. So if you're living, say, you know, in London particularly, there's a thriving West End theatre network here, and there's quite a bit of work in that area. Bridal wear tends to be a little bit more manufactured over in India, their beading parts. Also, 2 years ago when I first started, there wasn't that much manufacturing going from Sydney to India or to China, whereas these days there's a lot more. Mm. So I think my journey particularly was a response to my environment, so to where the work was. I think in each and every case, depending on where you live in and around the world, the amount of work that you do will vary depending on your experience.
Oh, okay.
So where you might start is, rather than beading a full dress, you might just bead part of a bodice, or you might add some beads onto an existing dress, or you might tambour a small panel that goes into a corset or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, you tend to, at the beginning, you tend to keep your pieces quite small and manageable, and then that way you don't get bored of them. And also too, you know, when your, I guess, speed builds up, you then want to normally approach bigger projects. So the beading in bridal wear can be just as difficult and intricate as the beading on haute couture and on theatre. So, you know, it just, a lot of it is response to where you are and what's available.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that wedding world. I did 10 years as a wedding photographer.
And, oh wow!
I know that world where there's emotion oftentimes overrides logic. Yeah, and
yes, definitely. And expectations are very, very high, as you can imagine. You know, and I imagine for photography, exactly the same.
Oh yeah,
you know, the expectations are just literally out of control, and you think, really?
Yeah. I know.
But, you know, you do your best. And I think you have to remind yourself when you're working with those gowns all the time, and I'm sure you did the same as a photographer, this is someone's pinnacle of their life.
Right.
And while it feels very usual to you because you've done, you know, you do one a week or a dress a week or photography a week, you know, this is someone's like wow moment of their life. So
you have to remind yourself all the time, lady, you're really being unreasonable and ridiculous. But I know it's your big day, and I'm doing another one next week. Yep, exactly.
That's right. Exactly.
Yep.
And just get through it, and it'll be over soon. That's fine.
Right.
Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes even, which is, I'm sure you've done the same thing, you look back on some of the things that you've worked on. And they might be one or two years past, and at the time they might have been really tricky, or the person might have been tricky, or, you know, the circumstances. And then you look back and you think, wow, you know, that's actually great that she was so tricky, because that looks really great in, you know, in retrospect now. I look back at that and, yeah, she was right.
Yeah. You have to ride with it.
Yep.
All right, so then what gets you to England? I mean, you've got a thriving business. You've got employees. What gets you to England?
Okay, so it's
that seems like a huge leap to me.
Yeah, it is a massive leap. When I was young, straight after I graduated my fashion course, I did some work in Australia. Then my husband and I got married, and he's English.
Oh.
And we went to the UK for 2 years for our adventure, and we thought that was going to be over. And, you know, as part of the adventure, you know, learning as much as possible and working in the industry and, you know, doing different things kind of opened my eyes. Then what happened was my business at the point just before 2010, I think it was, it started to naturally slow. Mm. A lot of work was going overseas to be produced in India and in China. And so the small production runs that obviously had kept my staff quite busy and kept me busy too were diminishing. And what that meant was that the staff who were with me who wanted to then go and start their own labels or do their own, you know, work, go off and have children, you know, having a lifestyle change, they kind of, you know, they left as time went on, you know, as that year went on. And so what I did was I didn't replace them.
Ah.
And it got to a point where things were very, very, very quiet. And I closed down the studio, and because it was just me and one other person that worked together then. And so it was like, okay, well, let's see what happens, you know. Let's just see what the universe is throwing at me right now. I'm responding to, you know, what it's telling me. And in 2009, I entered the hand and lock competition for embroidery in the open category. It started out originally as a student category, and then in 2009 there was an open category, and I thought, oh, you know, I'll give this a go. I've got some spare time. I'll put in an entry. And I did well. I got highest Australian entry, but I didn't get chosen for the three finalists. So I thought, okay, yeah, that's fine, no worries. It was just a great way to actually sort of do some work of my own, get back into design and actually produce my work, not somebody else's work.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2011, I had a quiet patch for about 2 months, I think it was. And I said to my partner, I said, oh, do you know, I really feel like doing this again. You know, I really feel like entering, you know, this prize again. And he said, well, go for it. You know, he said, have you got time? Have you got, you know, the time to do this? And I said, strangely enough, I do. So I put my heart and soul into it, and I had such an awesome time producing, again, my own work, to a brief, of course, but it was a really lovely brief to work with. Put it in, submitted it, open category, and I won first prize in the open category of 2011. I was just like, oh, my God. So I got a phone call at 3 a.m. telling me I'd won, because obviously the time difference in Australia and the UK is so different. And I think I was standing there half asleep, you know, on the phone, heard the phone go off, picked up the phone, oh, you've won, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, what? It was like I was dreaming.
It was so crazy.
Yeah. And so, you know, which led me to, as part of the prize, was to actually go and work at Hand and Lock for a couple of weeks doing work experience.
Oh.
Obviously going to, going to New York to accept the prize, which was fantastic. So we did that. And because work and the business had kind of almost sort of diminished to a point
where
you just blew by that.
That had to have been a life highlight to win that.
Yeah, it was. It really was. Yeah, it really was because it's an international prize. And I'd watched so many winners the previous years and just really was blown away by the standard of the work and the creativity. It was just awesome. And it still is quite an amazing prize. It's very different now to when I entered. Like, they've got a lot more categories now. They've got textile and fashion and all different things. But it's a really, really amazing creative people enter, and oh my gosh, and you know, to me, honestly, it was just a motivation for me to finish my work. I didn't think I'd win but I was so excited, like, it was brilliant. Oh my gosh.
Well, yes, so, I can imagine.
Yeah, it was wonderful. So so you know, my partner and I were like, okay, well, what do we do now? And it was like, well, should we go and move, should we go? And so we did. So we packed up everything, we rented out our house, and off we went to London. So, yeah, and I know. But it was almost like, you know, every little piece of the puzzle had aligned in a way that I felt confident enough to go.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like I was leaving anything behind. I didn't feel like I was missing out on anything. I still had that vivid dream of working in Paris. You know, I've had it all my life. Even my husband says to me, my God, when I first met you, that all you talked about was going and living and working in Paris in haute couture. And I was like, okay. So, yeah. So, you know, to me, that was then, being in London was one step closer,
right?
Paris. It wasn't that far away. You could get the train. Ooh, possibilities were getting more exciting. So, yeah. So I thought, well, why not? And, it was really great to move. A big readjustment, though, I have to say. When you move countries, you start from the beginning again, unfortunately. It would be lovely to say that, you know, basically everything happened to my advantage instantly, but no, it's like most things. You've got to make contacts, and, you know, you've got to show people you're there and what you can do and everything like that. But I was ready for it. Yeah.
But now, your business partner went with you?
No. She went on then to reinvent herself in an IT capacity.
What?
So she, exactly. And she's fabulous at it. She was in it for years as well. And, she's very clever. She's amazing. So, you know, and I think too, with some people, perhaps they do a particular thing for a certain number of years and then they're done.
Yeah.
You know, they like a change, or they want to, you know, they want to go into something that has a future, because with embroidery, it does have a future, but it's a bit limited, say, compared to, you know, now IT is, you know, how amazing, you know, since basically the internet has been invented, you know, we've got jobs now that we didn't even know would exist, you know.
Yeah.
So, and that can be really exciting and quite fun for people to aim towards and change their career trajectory. And yeah, so I think that's great. So yeah, I know. So
it's a left turn for her. Wow.
I know. Yeah. But you know, she's very, very smart. So she, you know, she's fantastic, and she did really well at that. And Yeah, so she's gone on to do lots of other things. I think she's changed quite a bit, you know, on and off with different jobs and different, you know, sort of, I suppose, what do they call it these days? Pivoting.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
You know, between different jobs. So,
well, that world is a parade of jobs if you're keeping up with the technology. That
absolutely.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, you don't just camp out someplace and do it the rest of your life, no.
That's right. No. And they actually like you to move around, it seems. So,
right.
Yeah, to, you know, have more skills and move and change and upskill and all of those wonderful words that are now so important.
So now you're in London and you, mm-hmm. do you set up a shop or do you just start doing freelance work? How do you play that?
I do freelance work mainly. And again, for me, that's pretty much answering to the, you know, opportunities that exist in London. With fashion, I go on site to work. So I'm still freelance, but they will book me for a certain number of days or times at the collections, in between collections, things like that, if there's, you know, process work to do. Also with theatre, I've got my own studio. So I work from my studio for theatre because the centralised system of having – or centralised system, the system of centralised studios isn't the same anymore because obviously in London it's quite expensive mm-hmm. to have a lot of space. So a lot of makers and a lot of, you know, milliners, you know, part process people, they have their own studios and so they work – their particular technique or part of the process from their own studios. So, yeah, so I tend to either, you know, work on site for fashion. If theatre want me to come in and actually work on maintenance or do different things, I can do that. That's fine. They just book me for that. And, yeah, so it's mainly freelance really. Yeah.
Okay, so that allows you then, because the one thing, many things I want to know about you, but haute couture, theater and, mm-hmm. and movies, film, which isn't film anymore, but, you know, three completely different worlds. If three jobs come to you today, do you have a preference?
Oh, depends on how much beating it. I like the big jobs. I like the big, big, sparkly jobs, to be honest. Like, and I'm a bit of a rarity. Like, I don't mind spending months on a piece. To me, I love the big, sparkly jobs. So,
okay, that's it. Yeah. Okay, blockbuster film, haute couture for some fashion house, or a big theater production, and all you care about is how many beads I can put on. Okay.
Yeah, that's it. That's what I'm driven. And because I guess with each industry in their own way, they all are fabulous. Like, they, you know, they're all wonderful industries to work in, and they're all a feather in your cap. Like,
sure.
You wouldn't say no to any of the three, really. If you could do them all at the same time, you would. But, yeah, one set of hands, not so easy. So, the one with the most sparkles, probably.
Okay. Well, that's, you know, that's your guiding light. That works.
That's it. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But I have to say, though, out of all the work that I do, fashion has my heart in the way that I just look at it and it's a dream to me because it's so elegant and it's so dramatic and it's so beautiful and technically brilliant. Like the technical expertise you need for fashion is something else. Like it's really, really high quality. Whereas with film, you will be doing something absolutely particular to a scene. So sometimes that can even set the mood or the tone for a scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be pivotal, you know, it can be quite important. And then theatre, I have to say, my gosh, the only time I really get emotional about my work is when I see the finished costume on stage under lights. Seriously, it's the only way beating should be. Really, it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. And so to me, if I can see my work like that, it's a real triumph because when – you're an embroiderer and you work on pieces, you're working on flat pieces of fabric. So as beautiful as the work is that you're creating, there's something absolutely wonderful and magical when a maker or someone you're working, you know, with in a team with puts that on a body and makes it fit like a glove and just makes it look the best it can look as well. And then that, you know, the fact that the beading goes together with, you know, and the embroidery that goes together with the making and the body of the person wearing it.
Mm-hmm.
When they dance around and, you know, they literally jump and kick through this amazing costume with all the beads on it, and all the beads still stay on. You know, that's such a triumph. Yeah, it's a triumph.
I wondered about that. Yeah, I wondered about that.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, you can imagine working for the three different disciplines. As much as you use the same skills that you have, you do apply them in slightly different ways because of the necessity for each industry. So with theatre, you need to make sure that, you know, the work that you're making is very strong. The work tends to be bigger and bolder and more dominant because you're standing quite away from it. You mm-hmm. know, the audience sits quite far away.
Yeah.
So it has to read really well from at least 2 to 3 meters away. There's no point when you're looking at it to stand up really close because you don't see half the detail. And then with film, you've got the detail of film and you have to have a bit of the precision of the haute couture because you see close-ups
yeah.
in films and things. So it can't look dodgy or and when I say dodgy, like it can't look gaudy.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to look a little bit fashion-y. And then fashion itself, because it's meant to be a working piece of art, like it's a wearable piece of art.
Yeah.
You know, the standard and the techniques and the sizes of the beads are just minute. The technical difficulty is higher. The precision is more involved. Like, yeah. So they, even though they're all related, they've all got their own sort of things that you need to really hone into in order to make them work.
Well, you know, that's something I wondered about, and mm-hmm. you know, this is the wrong word, but I've wondered if, when you look at the three disciplines, if yeah. one or the other, you could actually get a little loose, a little sloppy, where others you have to be so precise because of those close-ups that you have to be really careful. So it sounds mm-hmm. like with theater, you can get a little bit looser because of the distance. But then,
yes.
but then the durability has to be in there because it has to hold up performance after performance.
Exactly. So, you know, done a lot of beading for the stage show Frozen at the moment, for the mm-hmm. theatrical show Frozen. And she runs around on stage in that ice dress, glamorously running around, mind you. She
of
looks
course.
Absolutely beautiful. But she's got really beautiful big stones, like that are glass stones, Swarovski stones, and they're very, very sparkly. But because they're cut stones, they wear through the thread really quickly. So as much as they're bigger stones in certain places and then obviously they gradate to smaller just for an effect, they have to be sewn on almost crudely in order for them to be strong enough to stay on for more than one performance.
Yeah.
And, you know, with a beautiful long flowing dress, you know, actors on stage, they dance as well as sing and move and kick and do all sorts of things. I remember working on Lion King, for example, and back in Australia in the early 2000s. And we did a little Simba corset. That was the first one we did for a child Simba.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to go and have a dress, like a rehearsal. And they took the corset for the little Simba to wear, so he wore them. And we'd sewn all the carousels on at the front like we'd always had and everything, and that was fine. And we were really happy that they were going on perfectly and that they were going to be strong. It came back from that performance with half of the carousels at the front that were smashed.
Oh, no.
But the stitching was still there. The stitching was holding what was left of the cowrie shells onto the bodice. So we were like, wow, what is this child doing in this corset? Oh, my gosh. And it turns out once we'd seen them actually in action that he does do a little jump and slide along the stage on his belly, and it made sense. Of course, nothing is going to withstand that amount of pressure.
Yeah.
So, but happy to know that our stitches kept the remaining parts of the cowrie shells on. So felt like it was a good job done still all the same.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, when you do those, when you are, I suppose it doesn't matter what world it is, but mm-hmm. Say, for instance, theater, is there at least early on and certainly on film sets a time when you need to be there in case things need to be repaired, or are there other people for that kind of thing?
It depends on the show. With embroidery that I do, I tend to work in the beginning on the whole piece. Mm-hmm. And more often than not, they might have someone at, you know, say, for example, at the studio or at the wardrobe department who will do maintenance. And they will actually fix anything that's sort of happened or broken or disappeared or something after a performance. That's for theatre mainly. With film, there doesn't tend to be a lot of to-ing and fro-ing with the work that I do. With film, I tend to work on site. So if there's a problem, we fix it straight away.
Oh, okay.
Or if there's a change, more so than a problem. There's normally more changes than there are problems, really. It's just a change.
Yeah.
And we'll fix them and do them on site. And, you know, they hire you as freelance for a certain amount of time and they build factor a bit more time into that. But with film sets, I know when I say we, embroiderers, makers, you tend to have a department where you're housed, if you know what I mean. And, you know, different people come in for fittings and I'll have a dedicated space for those things, for fittings and everything. I don't tend to actually need to go into the fitting stage, so mm-hmm. I don't meet any stars, which is a bit disappointing, but anyway, can't have everything. So lucky the sparkles do it for me, so
right.
But yeah, so you know, quite often it then goes off to be fitted with the head cutter or the designer or whoever's doing the fittings, and then it will come back, and if there's any changes that need to be made or alterations, we'll do them then. So yeah. But you know, it's a bit of a process too sometimes from the beginning, because you will meet with a designer before they actually start making things and they'll have their brief or their vision of what particular costume they're wanting to embellish and what's the theme and what's the brief. And quite often they'll give you a lot of information. They'll give you a lot of pictures as reference. And what they'll do as well is if you need to, you know, if they want you to design something, quite often I'll sit down and draw at least three designs for every, you know, brief, if you like. And the first one is always really involved. The second one is a bit simpler. And the third one is done really quick, because I think it's important. Any more than three, people get overwhelmed. And anything less than three, people don't feel like they have enough choice.
Right, right.
And different levels of difficulty and amount of work, I think, is really handy, because you're responding to budgets as well.
Right.
So depending on the scene will depend on how much money they're spending on that scene. Also, too, depending on the character. So if the character is a really pivotal character, so a principal character, they tend to spend more money on, you know, their outfit or,
right,
you know, the embellishment on their outfit or whatever. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, I have to – I'm a Star Wars fan. And I have to say that I have to go back now and watch the one with Queen Amidala.
Yes.
To see your beading work, because I just remember that all of her garments were you know, obviously amazing and big and bold and shiny and all those things. But now I have to go back and actually watch it for that. And so yes. what's the experience on a huge production like that? You must work way ahead of time, or is it really kind of close to the moment?
It depends on the budget, and it depends, I guess.
It depends. It always depends.
The budget always depends. Hello, that B word. Oh my God.
Yeah.
But you know, unfortunately, it does. It depends on the budget, and also too, a lot of it depends on the production team. So with the production, there's a lot of things, obviously, that as part of the costume and wardrobe department, we don't get to see. We're not part of those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So quite often they might be starting well ahead of time in one particular department, but maybe our department doesn't need to get started until a bit down the track.
Yeah.
They always try and allow enough time, obviously, to make all the costumes. With film, especially on Star Wars, the hours are quite long, but everybody knows that and accepts that. The workroom is very big and it's got a lot of talented people working in there. And the designer's fantastic. Tricia Biggar, she was amazing. Oh, my gosh, it was such an absolute pleasure to work with her. She's just such an incredible woman. And, yeah, so and then you've even in the costume departments, you've got different departments within that. So you've got the embroidery department, you've got the dyeing department, You've got men's wear, women's wear, the cutting areas, the sewing areas. So it's there's quite a lot of people working at any given time. And, you know, everyone's pushing out as much work as they can. And every person who's working is to a deadline, I suppose. So they've got schedules for fittings and things like that that you have to keep to.
Yeah.
And, yeah, obviously then, you know, obviously not part of what I see because I'm at the beginning of the process. That's one thing with embroidery. We're at the start. You know, all the costume making and everything comes after us.
Okay.
We get the beginning of the costume making where the shapes and basic, you know, the basic shapes of the bodices and everything is put together. They have a fitting, an initial fitting, and then we get the fabric with the traced out pieces and we have to bead and embroider all of that. Then it goes off to be made, obviously by the makers. It'll probably go for another fitting or two or something like that. If we need to add more beading to it, we can. If it's a beaded piece that we add on after the garment's completely finished, then we come in sort of halfway through. But it just depends, yeah, on what type of look that the designer wants.
Okay,
and
so
things like
all right,
that.
So I had that wrong in my head then. So you're just working on swaths of pieces of cloth that you
yeah.
put on a frame and embroider.
Yeah.
And then it gets built later. Okay.
Yes, right. Yes. And the only time we'll do differently is when they want us to create like a piece that's an appliqué piece.
Mm-hmm.
So we can work on organza or netting and we can create that total beaded piece on there, turn the ends and turn the edges and make it like an appliqué piece that then can be applied to a finished garment. But that's a very specific request normally.
No, oh, okay.
Because beading tends to look a lot nicer directly onto the fabric of the wearer, if
yeah.
you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's almost a short, well, not really a shortcut, but it's almost a cheat to do it separately and then add it on at the end. Yeah.
yeah.
A lot of bride will do that because they're worried about the bride changing sizes and everything, so they put the beading on last.
Oh.
But yeah, it doesn't work well.
Yeah, it's
with kind
everything. Of like a patch rather than
yeah,
a,
yeah, yeah. Than but integral. It always yeah. to me it always looks like a patch though.
Yeah.
Do you not? I don't know. Just yeah. But you
well,
know,
yeah,
you've got to do what you've got to do.
It won't flow with body movement at all. Yeah, it just sits
yeah.
there. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So
okay,
yes,
so
and it's
gotta,
very.
I got to ask this question now.
Yeah,
okay. So
okay.
I'm a magazine editor.
Oh,
so, and,
wow, fantastic.
And that's, you know, that's a curse because you can't oh. read anything without editing it.
Oh, no.
you know what I mean? Like even yep. a novel, I just can't enjoy
yep.
it because I have to edit it as I go.
Yep.
So I
yep.
gotta believe seeing a film or a theater production or anything that happens to you too, that you can't
yes.
just enjoy it.
Yes. yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes. Well, you're always looking into it. A
right.
bit like what you're talking about too.
Right.
You know, you don't just look at it, you're looking into it.
Yeah.
So what that means is you go, ooh, close up. Oh, oh they use braid there instead of actually making that. You know what I mean? Like, and you can tell, especially with a lot of period costume work as well, you know, if the budgets are lower, they can't afford to make certain things specially. So they buy what they can and then reinvent it. So, yes, you're
okay.
very, very true. It's, it
okay.
spoils you forever.
The turning point of the film and you're looking at the beading. Yeah, okay.
Yes, yes.
All right, good.
Yep.
That makes me feel more normal. Thank you.
Yes, oh, good. Wonderful.
So what is today? What is your business today? Doing some design work, teaching, What is your life like these days?
Okay, so my life ebbs and flows, like you said, between design. So I help young designers realize their beading ideas and dreams and design beading according to that. I work with Disney and West End companies and production companies here in London who provide designs for me to bead and photo Bibles for me to follow exactly to produce a product that's, you know, pretty much uniform throughout every country that performance is on show. I do teach. I also sell online kits at the moment in my Etsy store. And what else do? I actually do embroidery and beadwork for
still able to do
still?
That. Okay.
Oh no. And to be absolutely honest, I love doing the work, we call it. primarily because I just love the making parts. So I try and embroider and bead as much as I can still. Also too, I work with different fashion companies when they have their designs and interpret their designs in beading using my technical knowledge to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to think what else. And yeah, that's pretty much
it. So you still have your fingers in everything in addition to creating your own kits and designs for people to learn with.
Yes, exactly. And I hopefully my plan is I'm ambitious. I've always got to have some plan, some dream to head towards. I'd like to go back to obviously haute couture fashion, but depending on how COVID goes, well, depends on, you know, whether that's possible short term or long term or how things go. But I do want to create my own pieces, my own designs, and really lavishly embroidered, technically sophisticated pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So stay tuned for those. They're going to take a little while to do. But in the meantime, I'm trying to obviously share all my knowledge as much as I can, teach as much as I can as well in between everything. I do love that.
That's interesting. The fashion, your heart still races when it comes to fashion.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I know. It's so crazy. And the fashion world is a really interesting place. You've got the people who love getting dressed up, and then you've got the people who love making the clothes for other people to get dressed up.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's really interesting that way. So, you know, you look at a lot of people who work in fashion and they don't look very fashiony sometimes, but what they create, oh my gosh, blows your mind and you think, wow, you made that. So, you know, quite often it's that's why it makes my heart sing, because there's a lot of creativity. The people that I work with are really interesting people, and yeah, it's just we all share a common passion, I guess. Yeah, which is really great. So, and I love actually in one way or another trying to impart that passion and the love for beading on clothing or embroidery on clothing, as well as for artwork or textile art, and to add to your own practice by teaching other people too, because I really think it's important not to lose certain skills. And I know we're not in any real danger because of, you know, so many people are passionate about needlework and keeping particular specialisms alive. So yeah, I'm happy to contribute to that and keep it going as well, be part of the army. So
fantastic. Well, Karen, this has been a real treat. Thanks for making the time to do this. This has been fun.
You're very, very welcome. Welcome. It's an absolute pleasure, Gary. Had fun today.
Yep. All right. And thanks to everyone for listening.